The Tinder app contains a location leak vulnerability. The United States Signals Intelligence Agency, that's the NSA if you were wondering, continues to spy, and the tech companies continue publishing transparency reports in response. Kaspersky Lab put on its annual Security Analyst Summit this year in the Dominican Republic. More trouble for Bitcoin. I feel like I say that every month. Internet Explorer 0 days, of course, and the RSA conference in beautiful San Francisco, California. Welcome to the Kaspersky Daily Podcast. I'm here, as always, with Chris Brook, a reporter from Threat Post. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing good. Got a beer.
All right. So, let's leave with the Tinder app. For the uninitiated, and you can count me among those people, Tinder is a mobile application that, as far as I can tell from the rather uninformative video on their website, lets its users scroll through pictures of other users that are physically near them. Apparently, those crazy kids were using it in the Olympic Village in Sochi to do whatever it is crazy kids do in the Olympic Village. At any rate, Chris, you covered this Tinder data leak vulnerability, and you're always on top of all the hip new mobile applications out there, so what exactly happened?
I'm on top of the apps. Not familiar with Tinder, though. I had to do just as much research as you did there. It's actually a location-aware dating app for Android and iPhone that's seemingly been all the rage for the last year or so. And they went ahead and patched a hole that could have let somebody track the site's users. Turns out that a researcher was able to analyze the app's API, determine exactly how far users were from each other. Turns out it was very specific, up to 15 decimal points. You could find out the mileage you are from somebody else. By creating multiple fake accounts, he was able to find out exactly where users last used the app and track them. Tinder fixed the flaw around the beginning of the year, but apparently it existed since July, if not earlier.
Oh, that's good. So you could basically pinpoint the location of any user, which is great for, you know, a dating app where people are putting pictures of themselves.
Creepy stalkers.
Yeah, you know who would love this vulnerability? The NSA. Boom. Shockingly, this was a relatively slow month as far as NSA revelations go, though from what I'm reading, NSA spying seems to be among the main topics of discussion at the RSA conference this month, though we'll get into that in a bit. However, the Justice Department eased its gag order on reporting of FISA request data. FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It's basically the law that authorizes data collection and monitoring by the NSA. So the DOJ, which, and that's the Department of Justice, by the way, they lightened up on some of their rules that prevented tech and telecom companies from reporting requests for customer data made under FISA. The tech firms wasted no time producing producing new transparency reports under the new guidelines. Twitter wasn't in love with the new rules, which essentially allow companies to report the number of FISA requests and national security letters they receive and how many customers are affected, but they can only really report them in broad ranges. Google, AT&T, Microsoft, Facebook, Yahoo, and LinkedIn all released their own new reports under the new rules. Their reports were all different, but essentially they all indicate, unsurprisingly, that the NSA is still interested in collecting communications data. Interestingly, as I said, these reports, they can report these in ranges of request numbers, but they aren't ever allowed to say they received no requests. For example, companies can report the reception of NSLs, which is industry speak for national security letters, in batches of 250, not from 1 to 250, but from 0 to 250. So essentially, no one's allowed to say that they're not receiving any NSLs, which I would think is so that, because if you say you're receiving none, then I guess you could say the NSA is not watching you. So that probably is the logic behind it, but seems a little strange. At any rate, let's talk about Bitcoin for a bit. You wrote very briefly yesterday, I think, or maybe the day before, about Bitcoin in your Pony botnet story.
Yeah. Dark, ominous times for Bitcoin this week. Its value sunk to about $500 on Monday after hovering around, I think it was $900, $950 last week, per Bitcoin, if you will. Mt. Gox, maybe the largest Bitcoin exchange, apparently shuttered on Monday. They deleted all their tweets. They shut down its website. Its chief executive left his post at the Bitcoin Foundation, which is sort of like a UN, I guess, for Bitcoin exchanges. This is after news leaked that the exchange had been the victim of a series of covert thefts over the last few months, totaling about $350 million. So, pretty hefty series of thefts. This is on top of news this week that a botnet, a special campaign using the Pony botnet, made off with about $200,000 in bitcoins and other cryptocurrency since September. This breach, or not really breach, but this campaign, cybercriminals took about 700,000 email and social media credentials as well before going dark in mid-January. Researchers at Trustwave Spider Labs, who found the botnet, set up sites to let users know if they were implicated in the attack.
Yeah, there seems to be a bit of a trend in cybercrime, cybercriminals going after Bitcoin and accepting Bitcoin for the ransomware schemes.
They want your money. It's still money. Yeah, to them, you know.
Oh, for sure. On a completely un-Bitcoin related note, we also had the Kaspersky Security Analyst Summit this month. I had never been before, but it was quite the extravagant affair. It was an all-inclusive rock and roll themed. Beach parties, wild monster trucking adventures. There were wild pigs and a lobster bake. We had dinner in a cave, which was cool. But really, all of that paled in comparison to the talks there. There was a really good lineup of talks. At times, I was sitting writing one story while another talk was going on, and I'd stop and look up and wish that I was writing about that talk instead of the one I was talking about. So I'm hoping, you know, next year I can plan a little bit better and get all the talks I want to write about written about. But the big story was the Kurito / the Mask APT campaign, which the Kaspersky guys, the great team, global research and analysis team, found right before. So Kostin Rayo, who's the director of the Kaspersky global research and analysis team, called it the most complicated APT campaign, APT is advanced persistent threat, that he had ever seen. One of the very different elements about the campaign is that the malware used in it appears to have been written by native speakers of Spanish. It has no apparent connection to the usual suspects in the APT game, and by the usual suspects in the APT game, I mean China. It targeted energy companies and government agencies in more than 30 predominantly Spanish-speaking countries. It's probably worth noting for a little context that some 387 million people in the world speak Spanish as their native language. It's second only to Chinese, so it's not altogether shocking that, you know, you would come across a Spanish APT campaign, or, you know, one that appears to have been created by people who speak Spanish. Another talk was Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek did their car hacking talk. Have you seen any of those videos, Chris?
Oh, they're a great time. I saw the Forbes one.
Yeah, so they had all their videos, and it was pretty much all the same. It's funny because I've seen another car hacking demo where these guys are like on a closed track. Not Charlie and Chris. They're just on like live roads and, you know, wherever they're doing this, cutting the brakes out on a car. At one point, actually, Charlie figured out that he could cut the brakes out on the car, but it only worked at below 5 miles an hour. So he was pulling up into his driveway and he went to hit the brakes and of course they didn't work, and so he accelerated to get it above 5 miles per hour so that he could then apply the brakes and ended up crashing into the back wall of his garage. but the new part of the talk is that they figured out that the way these sensors communicate with the computers in these cars is actually really easy to it's really predictable. So they think that like antivirus style detection can look for anomalies in the code that's going through the CAN bus, which is like the network in these cars, and essentially block it. So that was the new part of that. Then another really interesting demonstration was Vitaly Kamluk and Sergey Belov. They're both Kaspersky guys. And this guy, Annabel Sacco from Cubica Labs, talked about an attack that could remotely wipe all the data from a victim's machine. One of the researchers basically found an odd program on his wife's computer. It's called CompuTrace. It acted suspiciously like a piece of malware. It injected new processes, deployed anti-debugging protections and to obfuscate itself, to hide itself, and displayed an advanced resilience to removal. All these things are essentially, these guys said, is what malware does. Oddly enough, though, CompuTrace is installed in BIOS, which is the underlying system on PCs. Its task is essentially to initiate startup and some other stuff. Also, oddly enough, CompuTrace is totally legitimate. its intended use is to track lost computers, sort of like a Find My iPhone for your PC. Which Kamlik noted, you know, that sounds like a beneficial thing, but I think it was Sergey Belov who was the one who found the program on his wife's computer. He didn't turn it on, and his wife didn't turn it on, which suggests that it could potentially be enabled on millions of machines all over the world without their respective owners realizing it, which in turn, of course, means that millions of users are potentially susceptible to the attack that could remotely wipe all the data off their computers.
All right, moving on. Let's shift to Microsoft for a little bit. The folks at in Redmond there should have their hands full working on a patch for a new Internet Explorer 10 zero day that kind of popped up the other day. The company released a fix-it tool as a temporary bypass against it this week, but it's expected that they'll probably patch it the next patch Tuesday, March 11th. Security firm FireEye found the zero day a few weeks ago being used by two hacker groups trying to extort military intelligence from both the U.S. Veterans of Foreign Wars website and a French aerospace firm. The company is also readying a new version of its free toolkit, EMET, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, soon. Researchers at Bromium Labs this week were able to develop an exploit that completely breaks all of its protections. The issue is expected to be addressed in EMET 5.0, which Microsoft conveniently previewed this week at the RSA conference in San Fran. For what it's worth, the new version is expected to have a new feature, Attack Surface Reduction, ASR, that will let users determine when and where plugins like Java and Flash can be run by default.
Speaking of RSA, we're running a bit low on time, so I don't have...
Nice segue there.
I'm not going to say much about it. RSA is happening in San Francisco right now, which is a wonderful city if you've never been. A lot of talk of surveillance and NSA over there. If you want to read about it, swing over to ThreatPost. There's been a lot of coverage from our editors, Dennis Fisher and Mike Mimoso. If you're not the type that likes to read, they've got you covered with some daily podcasts as well. One last thing before we go. Chris, have you updated your MacBook?
I have indeed.
So have I. So that I'm referencing a very bad certificate-related vulnerability. Again, we don't have time to talk about. But if you haven't updated to the latest version on your MacBook or your other iOS devices, you should probably go ahead and do that as soon as possible. Thanks for coming on, Chris.
Of course.
And thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.